In chapter 17, chapter 17 is pretty hard to understand, but we've already looked at a lot of the elements of it, okay? So we'll just try to put some things together. I don't claim to have a complete handle on it. I think I got a handle on some of it, but it's just very hard to be sure. But what we have to do is interpret it in light of what we've already read. What we've read in Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 9, Revelation 11, 12, 13, it all kind of comes together in chapter 17. Verse 1, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Well, we've heard that one before, seven heads, ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, was adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And you know that when God calls spiritual unfaithfulness adultery and fornication, right? So that's likely what we're looking at here. On her forehead, a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. In 1992, the European Union officially became a union. And they had talked about it for decades, and they finally made it. And that was on the cover of Time magazine. And I cut it out, because I just couldn't believe it. Like, I said, what? You know, that's the symbol of Europe. Europe is named after the goddess Europa, okay? That's where how Europe gets its name. And so all these little people with the flags are all the different countries, and they're all saying, I think it's yes. And that's how they pictured it. I was thinking, gee, did they read the Bible? Like, did they do that on purpose? You know, are they trying to spoof the Bible? No, they don't do stuff like that. It certainly got a lot of Christians' attention because it's just too coincidental to be a coincidence. I don't know. It was on the cover of Time. I don't know if it was an artist. But it was something official. It was something produced by the EU, European Union. All these stars on the flag were the founding countries of the European Union. So it was kind of an official, but, you know, maybe it was embellished a little. There's some other ones that are official as well that look a little different, but I'll show you some more. There's always been a goddess worship on Earth. It's interesting that the Roman Catholic Church started, you know, with the early church and was responsible for... I guess a lot of the early, you know, things of Christianity, and then began to diverge around the 4th, 5th century into kind of a mixture of paganism and Christianity. And one of the things they did in order to spread the gospel, they spread it everywhere. And I was thinking, well, how did they do that? Like, you know, how did they have such great success? And granted, people were, you know, maybe didn't have as much to compare it with as they do today. But one of the things they did was they went into Europe, into the European countries, which were very pagan and backward, and they sort of put Mary into Europa's place, because Europa was the goddess, you know, the Mother Earth and the goddess, and so Mary kind of became deified. Then people could kind of relate, you know, because they had a goddess, and then, you know, Mary's a goddess, another name for the goddess kind of thing. And Jesus became just like the little boy. And in the Catholic Church, over the centuries, Mary became called the Mediatrix, meaning, as the Bible teaches, there's one man, one God and one mediator, the man Christ Jesus. In the Roman Catholic theology, Mary is the mediator between Jesus and us, if you're Catholic, which is really weird. Like, what do we need a mediator between us and Jesus? Well, we don't. We call this the priesthood of believers. The priesthood of believers means that you as a believer have as much right and privilege and access to God as I do as a pastor. There's no difference, you know, just because I do this and other pastors do this. We have equal standing before God because we're all saved by the same blood of Christ. Nobody's up here or down there. That's very different. The Old Testament, you needed to go through a high priest. Any other religion, you got to go through somebody. So in Catholicism, you have to go through the priest who still has to absolve you of your sins, and you still have to go through the church who has to declare that you're saved or not, and you have to go through Mary who talks to Jesus on your behalf. And it's such a corruption of the gospel. I've always been really bothered by it, although my background's not Catholic, but it's just such a blatant heresy. And yet, what is going on in the world today is a movement to unify all the Protestant and Catholicism. And they don't care about that. They don't care about these doctrines. I was at the Vatican, and anybody ever been to the Vatican? As a Christian, going to the Vatican is really weird because there's just so many statues. And in the Bible, they call them idols. So we always call them idols because that's what they are. And there's one of on either side, and I think it's either Peter or Paul, and then the other is on the other side. And what would they have done, according to what you read the book of Acts, if anybody ever tried to worship them, right, or put them on a pedestal? They would have torn their clothes and said, "Don't worship us, worship God." And all along the roof of the Vatican, you have these, I guess they're all the saints and the apostles and whatnot. And when you go through, it's just very pagan. That's really what it's like. You know, a lot of people don't care about this stuff anymore, but it's still, yeah. It's sort of like they'll use the Bible, but they have a doctrine or a statement of faith, just like any denomination. Huh? Yeah. Well, Rome killed Peter and Paul. And here they have a statue. You know, we went down to where Paul was kept in prison, the Mauritania prison, and there's still a little bit of it left. And, you know, that's where Paul was. Paul wasn't in the palace. He was down in a prison, you know. Why? Because for the gospel. Here's just an example. This wedding together of paganism and Christianity, that's at an obelisk. And there's one in the Washington Monument in the States. But this one's actually right from Egypt, because it was one of those Egypt worship symbols. And so on top of it, they put a cross, and that sort of is supposed to sanctify it. So they weren't just looking for a tower to put a cross on. What they were doing is bringing religions together and then showing that Christianity is kind of brings it all together and it's sort of superior to it. This is another European symbol. This is put out by the Council of Europe. It's the same symbol of the stars of the founding countries. Now, when you look at that, what do you see there when you look at that? Why would the Council of Europe use the Tower of Babel as a symbol of what they're doing? Like, it blows my mind. It's almost like if they knew it was in the Bible, they'd use something else. It's almost like they just didn't know, but it's absolutely incredible. And their choice of stars, those are satanic stars. You know, those aren't stars of David or other stars. Those are satanic stars. They represent the goat's head. And so it's Europe building this new nation. And a lot of, you know, we're still kind of waiting for Europe to kind of rise up and, you know, try to become world dominant, whether that happens or not. They're trying. Let me just talk about the Ecumenical movement just for a minute. This woman is Mystery Babylon the Great. This is the spiritual side of Babylon. So in chapter 17, you have what we would call the great harlot, religious Babylon. In chapter 18, you have the great city, and that's commercial Babylon or economic Babylon. And so Babylon represents all that is against God, and this is primarily the spiritual aspect of it, at least at first in control, kind of on the forefront. And so the symbols of the woman on the beast, the goddess riding the beast, you know, kind of controlling the beast, kind of, you know, I'm holding the reins of power sort of thing. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet. Those are the colors of religion. Those are the, you know, adorned with gold and silver and precious stones and pearls. False worship because it's called fornication. And then when it says, "I saw the woman," verse 6, "drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs," we're talking about the church, or at least some of the, you know, of ecclesiastical history that has killed followers of Christ, right from the time of the apostles right up through. So when we look at this woman, many commentators will say, well, this is the apostate world church. This is what world religion is trying to build. And it seemed to get quite a ways under with Pope John Paul. And after he died and this new pope comes in, he's kind of like not very popular. So it's just one of those things. Like it's like the peace treaty in Israel. It just sort of goes, but it's not getting anywhere. And the ecumenical movement's like that. But the ecumenical movement is very powerful. All the major denominations, liberal denominations in Canada, belong to it. And they belong to it for years. And they disavow the scriptures, and they come together just under unity. That's what all that matters. Who is going to head this world church? Well, there's really only one person, religious leader in the world, that has that kind of profile, and that's the Pope. And I would think the Pope would be the most likely one to head it. Whether it looks exactly like it looks now, it's really hard for us to say, but we can certainly see the similarities. Now, let me just give you a little history of Babylon as a mystery religion. Chapter 10 and 11 of Genesis, the Tower of Babel, right? That's where they, after they left the Ark and they built Babylon, and you have Nimrod, who was this great hunter and this great leader, and they were going to build the Tower of Babel, and they're going to build it up to heaven, and they didn't need God, and God scattered them. The legend of Nimrod. This is the legend of Nimrod. He and his wife Semiramis had a son, whose name was Tammuz. And Tammuz died, and Semiramis prayed for 40 days, and he was resurrected. And this story is an ancient story, and it's not just like in one country. So this is where this story pops up. The Greeks called it Aphrodite and Eros, right? The woman and the child. The Romans, it was Venus and Cupid. The Egyptians called them Isis and Osiris. The Phoenicians and the Canaanites called it Astarte and Baal. And they celebrated this resurrection with exchanging Astarte eggs, Easter eggs. Which is why every time Easter Sunday comes around, I keep thinking, why can't we come up with a better name than calling the resurrection of the Lord Easter Sunday? I loathe it, because this is the root of it. Easter is purely pagan. Astarte, Easter. Astarte, Astoreth pole. All through the Old Testament, you read about Astoreth poles, and they worship the Astoreth poles. That's Canaanite religion. Baal worship. So you have Astoreth, the woman, and Baal, the son, and it's a corruption of this early story of Nimrod and Semiramis and Tammuz, but it's a corruption of the Bible's story of a woman giving birth to the deliverer. It's incredible. So where do we see this? And it's in the Old Testament. Jeremiah 44:17. And, you know, Jeremiah was, you know, confronting the leaders of their idolatry. And this is how they answered him. Verse 17. We will certainly do whatever has gone out of our own mouth, to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and pour out drink offerings to her, as we have done, we and our fathers, our kings and our princes, in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem. For then we had plenty of food, were well off, and saw no trouble. But since we stopped burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out drink offerings to her, we have lacked everything and have been consumed by the sword and by famine. Well, the Queen of Heaven to them was Semiramis. Because what it was, they disobeyed God. God said, don't, you know, get mixed up in the religious practices of the land, which they did, and it corrupted them. And it just kept resurfacing and resurfacing. And then in Ezekiel 8, when Ezekiel is watching what's going on in the temple of God, just before the glory of God leaves the temple, you have this incredible picture of what's going on in the house of God. Ezekiel 8:13, he said to me, turn again, he's in the temple, and you will see greater abominations that they are doing. So he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house, and to my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. So you have this, you know, I guess probably it was a practice, like Tammuz had died, and they're weeping for Tammuz, and then he gets revived, and they, you know, and then they must, you know, get happy or something. And Semiramis is the mother. So this is a picture of the mother child, and this represents Semiramis and Tammuz. But it's very interesting. It's another reason why a lot of Christians don't, you know, give Christmas cards to show the mother and the child. Not because there's, you know, anything wrong with Mary or anything wrong with Jesus as a baby, but it does represent something in paganism that we stay away from. Because really the representation of Jesus, you know, is he's better by himself. Because whenever he's with in a picture like that, it's a subordinate position. And Jesus is subordinate to nobody. And so, you know, we deliberately don't put him in a subordinate position if we can avoid it. Well, yeah, it's sort of like exchanging Easter eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But what I'm saying is there's things behind things. And this is one of those things. Like, you would never think of that unless somebody come along like me and told you. Now, I probably messed you up forever. You'd be going, oh, I can't stand that card. But, you know, I think it's important that we know these things and avoid them. You know, I've been trying to call Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, ever since I got into ministry. And nobody's kind of got on the bandwagon. But anyway, it's just a peculiar thing to me. I'm not Catholic bashing, but you cannot help but look at Revelation 17 and idolatry throughout the Old Testament, the history of idolatrous religions, and what goes on today, and see some similarities. Pergamos was a church, Revelation chapter 2, and had priests. And priests wore crowns in the form of a fish for Dagon the fish god. Well, if you look at the Pope's hat and cardinals and all that, that's what they wear. They wear this thing that looks like a fish head. And they use the same name. The Pergamos priests wore the title Keeper of the Bridge. And I guess it's the kind of, you know, the bridge between man and Satan. Like, they're the keeper of the bridge, buddy. And if you don't listen to us, we'll deliver you to the devil. That's kind of what the keeper of the bridge means. The Roman equivalent of that phrase is Pontificus Maximus, which is the title of the Pope. Okay, so just so you'll know where some of this is, how this, some of this stuff is connected. So when the Lord calls this mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth, he's looking at idolatrous religion, and what he hated most of all was when idolatry crept into his true faith, like it did with Judaism and like it has with Christianity. It's just intertwined. It's everywhere. Well, we can't find everything out. I think we're accountable to some degree when we, when I say we, I'm not just like you as an individual, but just Christians in general. If we promote unity for the sake of truth, we're responsible for that. And I think there's times when we are to promote unity, but not to compromise on the truth. So it doesn't mean that we all should, you know, stay by ourselves and in a holy huddle till the Lord comes and shouldn't work with other Christians. But we should work with other Christians and not people who are, we don't know if they're Christians or not. Like, I grew up United, and by and large, the United Church of Canada has nothing more to do with the Bible and hasn't for 30, 40 years. They just don't. There's, there might be a few that do, but it's just a very small minority. And when I became a believer, my mother said, so you can become a Baptist. And I said, no, I'm going to become a believer. But to the United Church people, it's like, well, what do you mean? You know, we're believers. It's not the same faith. It was once, you know, but it's not the same today. They don't, yeah. It's more like the NDP, to tell you the truth. That's what I'd kind of liken it to. But a lot of Christianity, like the ecumenical movement, there's a lot of things that are pushed forward in unity, and it means, well, we just won't worry about the differences. And some differences aren't that big a deal, like whether you're Baptist or Pentecostal. That's not a big deal to God. What's a big deal is what are you doing with the Bible, and what are you doing with the cross, and the blood of Christ, and the deity of Christ. Those are big things. You put somebody else between man and Christ, God calls it an abomination. And so it's the big things that we need to be concerned about, for sure. No, it's kind of like pagan legend. It's the kind of, same kind of legend as, you know, Glooskap and the Five Islands and, you know, fighting with Beaver and I don't know. It's just one of those old, it's old legends. But the interesting thing about it is it keeps popping up in Phoenician, Egyptian, Roman, and Greek myth. The same story comes up. And that's because it's got an older root and it's Babylonian. And so that's why God calls it, you know, refers to it as Babylon or Babylonian, because that's where it originated from. Yeah, yeah, you can find it. Semiramis. Now we get to the hard part. Clear as mud. Okay, so verse 7, Revelation 17, the angel said to me, why did you marvel? Now he's looking at this woman on the beast, and he's just amazed. I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her. which has 7 heads and 10 horns. So we know it's the same beast. Okay? It's the same from Revelation 13. The beast rising out of the sea with 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman is on the beast. The beast, and this is another, this is Der Spiegel, German Time magazine, you know, Guten Morgen Europa. And there she is. She's on this beast. And this isn't, you know, North American artists. This is quite common in Europe's depiction of who they are. So here he's gonna clear up the mystery, but it's a bit foggy. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. So, in other words, the beast you saw lived, and then it didn't live, and then it'll ascend out of the bottomless pit, which we read in Revelation 13, and then go to perdition. Okay, so it's sort of the history of the beast. The beast lived, he was not, he lived again, and he's going to go to hell. Those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. And beyond, that's about as much as I can tell you about it, because it has to do with a historical existence of this beast. Again, when we're looking at the beast, we end up looking at a man, right? And when we talk about the resurrection of a beast, and then later in Revelation 13, it's like talking about the resurrection of a man. And so the way the Bible kind of intertwines them is, it's hard to, you know, to just kind of break it down, if you will. Well, the beast is a system. The beast is an empire. The beast is Satan's rule. You know, it symbolizes Satan and his rule, and it also symbolizes the last ruler, the coming world dictator, the Antichrist, if you want to call him that. So let's look a little farther here. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. Now, we talked about the heads before as being empires. John, who is lived through the worst of Rome and, you know, destruction of Jerusalem, the killing of the apostles, the persecution that went on daily throughout the Roman Empire. And John, you know the history of John, they boiled him in oil, and he lived, and they banished him to the Isle of Patmos. So there he is, he's like 95 years old, and they couldn't kill him, you know, until he gets this revelation from the Lord. So he knows all about this beast. You know, he sees it in action in his day. And a lot of commentators say that he would have understood the 7 mountains as Rome. That's what a first century Christian would have thought. The 7 mountains, yeah, Rome is built on 7 hills. And it literally is. There's 7 hills that Rome is built on. So, is it empires? Is it hills? I think both are involved, because the Roman Empire is involved. The Roman Empire is one of those mountains. Okay, there are also 7 kings. So if mountains are empires, kings are leaders. 5 have fallen. One is. Well, the one that was the Roman. The other has not yet come. Well, it's like the feet and toes of the Daniel's image in chapter 2. That part hasn't yet come. The Roman Empire came and went, and we still have its divisions today, east and west, especially in Orthodox and Catholic Church. The other has not yet come. It's what we call the revived Roman Empire, which I think is what the European Union looks like. When he comes, a king, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the 8th. I wish he had to put that in there, because that's hard to make sense. But what it is, the beast comes out of the 7th empire, the 7th ruling, last days world empire, Western empire, we'll say. And he tries to establish his own empire. He comes as a king. Maybe he's, you know, one of 10 equal rulers. He subdues 3, and he starts boasting, and he starts doing, and he starts amazing the world, and he brings peace and all these things. And he doesn't regard God or anybody else. He only has regard for himself, to the point where Paul said he gets in the temple of God and sets himself up as God. And so that's what I think that's talking about. He's the 8th. So I think that's the Antichrist. He's of the 7. And is going to perdition or destruction. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So those are the 10 horns that are on one of the heads of the beast from Revelation 12. And the same as the 10 toes of Daniel chapter 2, and the 10 horns from Daniel chapter 7. They have power at the time of the end with this beast. They are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Look what it says here. They will make war with the Lamb. The Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. That's where it's heading, right? That's where this alliance is heading. It's heading to a conflict with God. I don't know if you're into weirdness like this, but I remember the first time I heard the phrase New World Order was George Bush Sr. when he was president. He was talking about a New World Order after the Gulf War. The old American dollar bill has it's had it all along, right? Novus Ordo Seculorum, New World Order. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff said about American architecture of Washington and stuff that's on the money, but that's weird stuff to put on your money, right? I mean, we put prime ministers on our money, but they put pyramids with all-seeing eyes on them. Anyway, just something about New World Order. A New World Order is in the making. The New World Orders just don't pop up overnight. Somewhere back, whenever that $1 bill was designed, and that's not just like the $1 bill, that's the great seal of the United States of America. So I'm not sure how old that is, but I'm thinking it's like, you know, 1789 type thing. Like, that's old. Their idea of a New World Order was getting away from Britain and establishing a free, liberated country. The European Union has declared, this is one of their statements or policies, that a one-world religion is necessary to bring about world unity. And it's true. How else, you know, because they blame all the conflicts in the world on religion. So if we could just get all the religions together, that would probably take care of all the conflicts. And they're partly right. I mean, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. And they're just looking at the wrong solution. But they think that they could just get the leaders of the religions to agree. The Catholics have been working with liberal Protestantism for years. Now they have summits where Buddhists and Islam folk come to Rome and have a conclave and all that stuff. And the Catholic Church wants to administer the Temple Mount. The Arabs say it's, the Muslims say it's theirs, and Jews say it's theirs. But the Catholic Church, because it says it speaks for you and me, and whenever you listen to the Canadian news, you would think it speaks for every Christian on earth, because no other Christian gets, the only other Christian gets publicity is, what's his name, 89-year-old guy. Like, who else gets any publicity, right? It's the Pope gets the publicity. So he's seen as speaking for all of Christendom, and he has said, wait a minute, there's a third group that has an interest in the Temple Mount, and that's Christianity. And we, as the Catholic Church, we'll administer that. We'll take care of that. And I could well see that happening. It kind of makes sense. Somebody's got to kind of administer. But that's one of the policies that both the European Union and the Catholic Church have. And if you know much about European history, there's always been a weird relationship between the Vatican and the heads of state in Europe. The popes used to crown French kings and German kings and English kings, and they would, you know, they didn't have the power they had in the Middle Ages, but they still have a lot of clout. And I think their clout will increase. Where are we here? Let's just read the chapter, and we'll just go over that to kind of sum up. He said to me, verse 15, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So she represents all these people. All these religions have gotten together into this one. The 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. The woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. As if we weren't confused already, now he's got to call the woman the great city. Jerusalem is called the great city in Revelation, but so is Babylon. And I think here he's talking about Babylon. Well, I think the biggest would be that the woman in chapter 12 gives birth to the Messiah. And the woman in chapter 17 is drunk with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. What's that? Yeah. I don't think it's the same woman. Yeah, there's possibilities. I know. And there is a reference, because that's what always got me, right? The great city. Oh, geez, you had to put that in there. But Babylon is called the great city in 14:8. Another angel falls, saying, Babylon has fallen, that great city. She made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And that's why I think it's referring to Babylon. I don't think it's referring to a physical religious Babylon as much as a system of religion. What? Yeah, Great Babylon. So both are called. Jerusalem's called the great city, and so is. And I think it's different. 18 doesn't fit Jerusalem. Especially because he just keeps, you know, calling it Babylon over and over again. I think he's shifted. I think he's shifted away from Jerusalem toward calling it, because he's talking about Babylon from 16, well, really from 14 on. But anyway, I can see what you're saying. Just to kind of sum up, I guess, the dragon has 7 heads, 7 crowns in his head, and 10 horns. That's Satan. The dragon is Satan. The beast out of the sea, 7 heads, 10 horns, and 10 crowns on the horn, meaning those horns are ruling with him. One head is a fatal head wound. It could be the revival of this revived Roman Empire. It also could be some kind of to do with the Antichrist, this little horn. You know, I wouldn't rule out that there is some kind of fake assassination, possible resurrection, who knows. The beast of the earth is the false prophet. He's not mentioned a whole lot here, although he will be in chapter 19. Woman on the scarlet beast, the prostitute, the great city Babylon. Unified religion supported by the 10 kings and the beast, then destroyed. They will use this woman on the beast until they don't need her anymore. Because I'll tell you, a lot of those European Union people who would say we need to unify world religion to get world unity, they don't care about world religion. It's just, let's just get it out of the way. That's kind of what they're thinking is. The scarlet beast, the beast that once was, now is not, the empire Antichrist resurrected, comes up from the abyss as an 8th king or an empire. 7 heads or 7 hills in which the Roman woman sits, a reference to the city of Rome. I think that's pretty likely. So you're looking at, you know, empires and Rome, and, you know, I can't tell you more than that. I don't have it all figured out. I haven't read anybody that has it all figured out. It's just very, very, very difficult. The 7 heads are 7 kings. 5 have fallen. Well, if you look back in ancient history, there was major empires that have fallen. We know they're empires because Daniel told us they were empires. So you have to go with, you know, that's how you have to focus your interpretation. And it has to be informed by Daniel. 5 have fallen. 1 is, that's Roman. 1's yet to come. That's the revived Roman Empire. 10 horns or 10 kings rule along the beast at the end. Now, you know, granted, this isn't the last word on this, but it's really hard to find any other interpretation that is coherent. Because you can go all over the place with this, but you got to find some coherency. Here he's called the Scarlet Beast in chapter 17. Where is he? Good question. We're out of time. Not quite. I just can't. Yeah, could be. It'd be good to study all the, again, take all those beasts and all those references and just chart them. And see how confusing it is. That's, you know what that is? That is a European Union phone card. And Europa's always on the beast. That's the euro. You ever get a euro? There's a woman on a beast. It's everywhere. It's the European symbol. And I just think it's really close to that. Well, it's just, because it's like it's even on their money. And that's really where that's where the rubber meets the road, right? What's that? The golden cow, yeah. Yeah, well, the bull and Baal, you know, it's always been kind of a pagan symbol, worship symbol. We don't have time to go into 18, and I didn't think we would. 18 seems to be a little simpler. If you read it seems to be talking about a city. I never used to think that Babylon would be rebuilt, and then, of course, King Hussein come along, and he's got had half of it, not Hussein, Saddam Hussein, come along and built half of it. It's possible, and some people think that Iraq could become the economic megapolis of the Middle East, you know. And it is possible that Babylon could become, I've always pictured, I read Revelation 18, it's like New York City, you know. It's just it's a great commercial empire. And the reason I think that it really doesn't have anything to do with Jerusalem is what it says about it. Babylon the Great has fallen, verse 2, has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. All the things that God detested is what Babylon is going to become, and that's not Jerusalem. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. And I'll tell you, it's the same kind of system we see operating today. It doesn't matter what the policies of the country are. We just want to trade your goods. We don't care if you're buying and selling people. We just want your business. And that's the kind of world we live in. And it really kind of shifted that way back when, the U.S. president and the prime minister started taking everybody to China. And there's, people don't care about these things. You know, there's, what did we read in Proverbs there Sunday? The righteous care about the poor, the wicked have no such concern. They don't care. And this is what they're heading for. Revelation 18 is all about the fall of the world economic system. So 17 seems to be about the religious system, 18 about the economic system. It's kind of like a slow death, I guess. It's being destroyed. It's being destroyed. But I think when he's looking at this, he's not just looking at, you know, great times in the year 6.5 of the tribulation, but he's looking at the whole history. It's like almost like world history you're looking at, you know, of this big, huge conglomerate that just keeps getting bigger and richer. And you know, that's how I look at it anyway. I think it's a snapshot of world, the world and its history. It gives you kind of an insight into what God thinks about the lust after money. Well, it's 9 o'clock. I'm glad it's 9 o'clock tonight. It's getting hard. You guys keep twisting up my brain with questions. But it just shows you, right? It's to try to keep all this information and, you know, and every once in a while somebody will say, what about this? And it's like, oh, darn, you unraveled the thread, you know, and I thought I had it, right? But that's what prophecy's like. That's why you can't get too twisted up about it, okay? You got to know the basics, right? And if you know the basics, you can tell others. When it comes down to the exact details, the best Christian minds wrestle. And you read their books and you wrestle with them. Next week, read 19 and 20. And that'll be the last night. I'm planning to put my... I've got all these notes. And I think I'm going to put them on a disc with the PowerPoints. I'm hoping to. And if you wanted to do some study on your own, at least be a jump off, you know. So I'll try to get... If I don't have it ready next week, I will have it someday. Summer's coming, man. I might just get too busy. I don't know. Too busy playing ball. Let's pray. Jerry, do you want to close us in prayer, please? Amen. Just one more thing. You see the importance of the Old Testament? Understand the New Testament? I'll tell you, it's all... So somebody said it's all in that Old Testament, right? It's unveiled in the New, but you got to know the Old Testament as much as you can.